Say What? Say What radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.
Welcome again to the Say What show on a special presentation of an audiobook that will then be made into a textbook, not textbook, but, you know, print, called Woo Woo Reality. This is, I'm calling them chapters, chapter two. And I'm actually recording it on the 11th of December, 2025. After I edited the first hour and put it up, I realized that, okay, we covered a story, a ghost story, about the Parkett family. And I said something there that wasn't accurate. They went through a horrendous number of very 3D type of, let's say, paranormal activity. The father expanding the cellar, dug up some human bones, or what looked like human bones, did nothing about it. That seemed to touch off a series of, let's say, very weird events. Well, as a kid, well, I was 17 years old, but I'd never heard of ghosts and this type of haunting and stuff. It never came across my radar. So I initially couldn't quite believe it, but I knew that the people that were telling me the story believed it. So anyway, the error that I made was I was discussing a situation where Mary, the middle daughter, there was Aggie, the older one, Mary, the middle, and Annie. And then they had a couple brothers. The thing about it was that she woke up from a dream because she felt hands around her throat, choking her, strangling her. I had forgotten what she said about those hands. She said they had gloves on. She didn't see a person. She saw the hands with the gloves on. So she's not screaming or hollering because she is essentially being strangled. And then Annie did come into the room. But she wasn't the one doing the strangling. All she did was turn the light on. And when the light came on, the sensation of being strangled left, and Mary's, you know, there gasping for breath. Okay, now, as I was saying, oh, wow, how did I mess that up? Because Aggie said that she had no idea why she said the light came on. That's when she woke up, after she turned the light on. So she wasn't being brought to the room or brought in to turn the light on because of something, noise or whatever that Mary was making. And maybe it was just a dream. If it hadn't have been for all the other weird 3D situations that just couldn't, or didn't, let me say, as a 17-year-old, I didn't go, oh, wow, this is what it's really about. So I want to just go back over that because it's kind of an important story. Okay, we can look at the blood that came out of the faucet, and it was from a well. So maybe some animal got in there, I don't know, and, you know, it was sucking up blood. I don't know what could have been, but there could be a 3D explanation for that phenomenon. The little guy who was going from the second floor to the first floor down a ventilation chute, maybe he just got too big and he got stuck. You know, they didn't think so, but maybe. But the one thing that really didn't have an explanation that I could come across or come up with was the cigarette in the window. The people inside the house could see the cigarette lit and somebody, puffing on it so it would get brighter. And the guy that went to the outside and looked at the porch and the window, and there was nobody there, and yet they were still seeing the cigarette inside. I can't quite come across anything that makes any sense there. But there was another episode that I didn't, a couple more that I didn't talk about. One of them was that Mary was upstairs and she looks out. She just sort of, glanced at the window, front window, and she could see a car coming down into the driveway, and it stopped in front of the house. She realized it was her boyfriend's car, and Annie got out. Okay, Annie got out of the car. They went back in the car, and off they went. Well, actually, Mary assumed that because as soon as she saw that Annie just got out of her boyfriend's car, she went downstairs, and when she got out there was nobody there. So she assumed that Annie got back in the car and they drove off. So a few hours go by before Annie gets home. And as soon as she gets there, Mary's all over. What were you with my boyfriend and blah, 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 blah. Now, this is where Annie said, "How did you know I was with your boyfriend?" They had both gone to some kind of an event and met up. They didn't meet up. They just, all of a sudden they were, "Hey, how are you?" So they did spend time together. But he did not give her a ride back to the property. And that is another one of those. What would that all be? Could Mary have been somehow hallucinating that? I guess so. I mean, there'd been a lot of weird things in the happening there. Maybe, in fact, she did. So we've got the concept that Mary could have had a dream and Mary could have hallucinated the Annie thing. And there's two, and they also would hear like chanting. And the whole people, any people in the house would hear the chanting. And I mean, a couple of times they went down to see if they could see this group of people chanting, but they never could find them. So these are basically 3D events, except for the Mary situation, both times where she could have been dreaming and she could have been hallucinating. There were two other episodes that Mrs. Parkett, their mother, told me about. The first one, her mother, the husband had left, and the mother's mother, their grandmother, was living in the house. She wasn't doing well physically, so she was not, really up and about. And one day, Mrs. Parkett hears her mom yelling, and she goes in there, and her mother's all upset. She claims that Aggie, the oldest daughter, was trying to poison her. Well, Mrs. Parkett, because of all the weird things that were happening, there was other stories, but all the weird things that were happening, she wasn't sure if her mom was hallucinating or something weird had really happened. So then, after her mother passed, Mrs. Parkett herself woke up and saw her mom walking in the bedroom, but she had chains on her. Now, again, could this be a very vivid lucid dream or a hallucination? Or there could be another explanation of what may or may not have happened in that environment. All I was sure about was that the people that were telling me the stories believed it. Okay. And the other thing I can't tell you is where did the footprints come? minutes before they got the notification that their mother had died in the hospital. Where did that come from? In the snow, on the porch, with a knock at the door, nobody there. This is one of the problems that we have when we're talking about woo-woo weird stuff. Because a lot of times we can give explanations, we can explain it away. Now, I was kind of, like I say, with the Catholic Church spirituality thing and their spirits and stuff, I wouldn't have fought against that. It's a fundamental thing that we were taught. So yeah, maybe there are spirits, you know. I didn't question being in the body of a Nipmuc Indian. Now, the picture that I put on the promo for last week's show, there's a picture of an Indian. I get it. This is a kind of a side thing, but it's sort of the same thing. When I was putting that together, I went to an AI picture drawing site and I said, a Nipmuc Indian running in the woods. And I wanted them to draw it. Well, when you put something like that in, it comes up with a bunch of similar drawings that's done. And I've been using this program for quite a while now. I get spooked out sometimes because I'll have a picture kind of in my head, but how do you put it in words so that the AI understands it to give it to you? Not very often. But the previous AI pictures that are there, very often, something very, very similar to what I had in my head is already done, already there. And I've discovered that except for one occasion, I would find it either in the first row, the second row, or the third row. And very often it was in the third position. I can't tell you what all that means, but the picture that you see on the promo is basically the picture of the Nipmuc Indian that I absolutely, as a 8-year-old kid, felt like I was in his body running through the woods. So as you get older, and probably a little more pessimistic, maybe there comes doubts about all this stuff and it never happened to me. I just kind of like, well, it could be real or maybe it's not real. But I wasn't vested in the outcome of the story. It was like interesting woo-woo events. So these things stuck in my mind, but when I get something like that, like the ghost story, my inclination is to find out more about it. And that's why I started to, well, I read The Demonologist by the Warrens. And after reading that book, which I couldn't tell you the details of now, but after reading it, I was very much, let's say, willing to think in terms of demonic spirits, evil spirits, some kind of a Satan energy. I found it very, very disturbing. And I kind of like didn't want to think about it. So I didn't do a deep dive into this. I didn't immerse myself into this. And this is all before the computers come out. Way before. You'd have to find books at the library that were on those subjects. You didn't see, documentaries on TV and that sort of. No, it was research was difficult. Let me put it to you that way. It wasn't easy like it is now. Okay, I'm looking at my notes here. Okay, so we got through that. Okay. Now, all I'm pointing out here is that because I was paying attention to what was happening around me. I was being taught, maybe is the only word I can come up with, to be open-minded about all this stuff. Could be not. Okay. But the other thing that was happening was my research into the JFK situation. Because again, it was very difficult to research. I had to go into the big city's library to access magazines and newspapers that may to give me something about the assassination that I didn't know. And so I was doing that, and I came across the FBI report. And they know who these guys are now. I don't have their names in front of me, but they know who these guys are now. A lot of research has found out, and they actually wrote a report about the autopsy and everything. And yes, they confirmed that there was at least one, and I think it was Humes, said this was like the that the body's been already autopsied. And the thing that happens here in this story about the Kennedy research, I was led to see David Lipton's book, Best Evidence. It was expensive, but I had to have it. And in it, it was the key to what could have, as bizarre a story as it is, two bodies switching them out, crazy stuff. But the reason that Lipton got committed to writing the book regarding the what happened to Kennedy's body, what really happened in the autopsy room, was because he took a testimony that Hughes, the doctor that was the forensic at the Bethesda Hospital, who was the only forensic doctor, they look at dead people, and he testified before the Warren Commission that was put together in Congress to analyze the Kennedy assassination. This went on a few months after it, and I think it was published a couple of years after that. So Lipton takes this explanation that Hughes gave in testimony and gave it to a friend of his that was a neuroscientist, physician. He did open, he worked on the brain and he was familiar with autopsy work. So he reads what Hume said, and he told David, he said, this guy is saying that when he took the sheet off of the body, it looked to him like the head had been autopsied. And when he took the brain out, he didn't have to cut anything. He just pulled it out. It wasn't attached. So with that testimony, that's what drove David Lipton to look very deeply into tracing what happened with the body. I wouldn't have known that initially if it wasn't for finding that one article in the Chicago Tribune. I wouldn't have found the Lipton book just showed up in my little store, my little bookstore. And I was drawn to look at it. Then, after reading Lipton's book, there was something that he was talking about that I wanted to know more about. And it was, he referenced a book on Lee Harvey Oswald. So I go to the bookstore, I say, do you have this book or can you get this book? And so they looked it up and they said, oh my God, yeah, we can get it, but it's very expensive. It was way beyond what I could spend. And I said, okay, all right. So I go to my next stop, which is like, it was Zayre's, but many people don't know that. But that was the first type of store that, now we would know is Kmart or a dozen others. And I go in there and they've got this big area of discounted books. I mean, there are over 100 in this bin type of thing. And I go over there and like sitting on top is the very book that I had asked the bookstore if they could get it. And I paid a dollar for it instead of all the money that, you know. And in there, I found out a lot of information that led me to believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was an operative for the US government. It turned out to be probably the US Navy. You can read all about my interpretation of what happened to Kennedy in Cosmic Reality, the first book, the John Kennedy Jesus Christ Connection. And that book is, you can get it as a PDF. You can still buy it off of Amazon, but you can get it as a PDF by going to cosmicreality.com. Or, you know, look down in the description here. There's probably a link to the PDF, and you can find out exactly what I'm talking about, because I'm not going to get into a rehash of, you know, what really happened that day, except regarding the woo-woo that went on to lead me down a road of research to be able to unravel it. This has been my entire life. I don't believe in coincidence. I don't believe in synchronicity. I believe that there's thought and action. I believe that if we think, gosh, I need that, and we put it out in such a way with a lot of energy behind it, it manifests. Some way or another, you're going to get it. Now, a lot of people go, yeah, I do that all the time, but it doesn't happen. I can't explain to you exactly the mechanism. I'm working on it. I'm still working on it, of what allows a given thought to manifest, and to manifest rather quickly compared to other thoughts. Well, I need a big house. I need a bigger house. And you know, that don't seem to happen. there's some kind of mechanism, I'm sure. I just haven't discovered But right now, we've just looked at, well, is this woo-woo world that I'm presenting here, is it real in the concept of it a 3D real that can be explained? Or is it real because evil spirits and energies can actually create havoc on this side of the, let's just call it the veil? It's a progression of learning. And my belief is, I have a mission at the soul level to do certain things. So the things that will help me, they just manifest. And sometimes the information comes from a weird, weird place. Okay. When I got to college, I was like a freshman in college. There was a man who was going over the, you know, different colleges and universities talking about the Warren Commission report, which had been published a few months before that. And I go and I listen to it, and there weren't very many people there, maybe two dozen, maybe less than that, in like a lounge area of the dormitory. So I'm listening to the guy, and I've got with me a file that's about, it was about 3/4 of an inch, maybe an inch, because all this research I'd been doing since I was 15, you had to write it out. You didn't have computers and printing and all that good stuff, you know. Copy and paste. No, I didn't have any of that. But I did have this notebook. So the guy's given his presentation, and I said to him, well, what about the third bullet hole? And he said, well, what are you talking about? And so I got to my FBI notes on the FBI testimony from the Chicago Tribune. And I said, well, it says here that these guys saw a third, everybody, I mean, they were autopsying, and they found a bullet hole that was in his back, in the center of his back, up low, much lower than the supposed neck shot. But it was, Hughes actually probed it. And he said, this is weird. It's not like it's a bullet hole, but it looks like a bullet hole. I just can't get the probe in very deep. So, not knowing what that was, Hughes actually doctored up the written documents of the autopsy and took that out. But the FBI had already squealed in the Chicago Tribune. They later on, they got, I mean, they've got documents where they do talk about it officially. So this is a known story. I think it was just, I don't think that Hughes was trying to cover up anything. I think he just wanted this thing over with and was trying to keep it from having more controversial aspects to it. He's dead, he's buried, let's get on with it type of thing. Military people can be like that. And doctors can really be like that. My opinion. All right, so I leave this thing, I go back to my dormitory, and a few days later, I was like, where's my file? And I freaked out because I mean I actually could remember bringing it back and putting it on the desk, but it wasn't there. So you get busy with college, and my freshman year was not the best year of my life. And I kind of like put the JFK thing on the burner. I didn't think about it, and I didn't, what was I going to do? I couldn't find the file. I mean, I just left it and sort of walked away from it, didn't get all crazy about it, and nothing I could do. Okay, so we flash forward. And it was, oh gosh, let me think. This was probably, that was 1970, 71. So 4 years into, no, more than that, 76, about 5, 6 years into the future, I'm living in Coral, Coconut Grove, Florida. And there is, this little cabin thing that we were living in was one of the original buildings that they put up because it was a resort. It started out resort area, and people would have to come by ship into Miami area, and then this was one of the places they would stay. So it was a very unique building, but it had a fireplace. So somehow or another, I hear about this woman that can deliver you some firewood. And I call her up, and the firewood was really cheap. And she comes over and opens her car trunk and has a stack of the wood, brings it over, brings it up to the porch area. And she says to me, did you go to the University of Massachusetts, and did you hear? And she gives the name of this guy who I can't remember what his real name was now, but at the time I remembered, and I said, yeah, I think that was his name. Yeah. And he talked about the Warren Commission. I said, yeah. And she said, well, 2 weeks later, he died in Boston, Massachusetts, in a barroom brawl. And she turned around, walked away, got in her car, and drove off. Those are the things that when I talk about woo-woo, that's a woo-woo event. And my interpretation of it is, this is a spiritual entity who is somehow manifested or taken over the body of somebody else to give me a message that I never. There was, why would I mean, this was years later. If I didn't hear about it at the time, how am I going to hear about it years later? It was a barroom brawl. But she knew I had been there. I heard it. She told me the story, and off she goes. This is one of the, and these are not the, that's not the only time that's happened. Sometimes I've been in a bar. This is normally a bar. And I'm sitting next to a stranger. And sometimes it goes one way, sometimes it goes the other way. Sometimes the stranger says something to me that is like, whoa, that's interesting. Out of the blue, something that, kind of made an aha moment in my head. But then there's the other side of it. It's the side when I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I start to get messages about the person next to me. And I'm drinking, okay? I'm a little tipsy. So when you're that way, your brain is not logical. It's just going with the flow type of thing. And so I just start talking to them, and I couldn't even tell you what in the heck I was saying. But they're like, oh my God, yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's very true. And then I never see him again. To me, those are mystical kind of meetings that we have to be the voice of spirit telling somebody something, or for them to be getting the messaging that you need. And I'm absolutely sure that most people don't pay attention. You remember in the first chapter, I said, the secret is be aware. So I think this happens a lot, but people aren't aware of it. That, okay, you got the message. Maybe it makes sense to you. Maybe it makes an impact on you. But how many of us really go like, yeah, but how did I get that message? Who is the messenger? Who was sending it? And this is the reason I said it's a secret to be aware, because once you're aware, then you can analyze the woo-woo moments beyond either accepting or not accepting. And that's why I again stress that be aware, because you'll find out a lot of really strange things. So you got strangers that come up to you. But what if you hear voices? This is something I hadn't considered. I mean, I've heard stories of saints and people hearing voices, all the time. So it wasn't something that I would have dismissed because, again, part of my religious background. When I was a, let me think, I was a junior in college. College was hard for me in a lot of ways. But in my junior year, we had just started. I had chosen the course of physical education because I was good at basketball, basically. I didn't really understand the options I had. Nobody explains it to you, really. And the only reason I went to college was because my mother and father told me I was going to college. It certainly wasn't something that I had this desire to do. It was just something that was expected that I do. So I was in physical education, and that was a bad decision. My school, because of a fire at the elementary school, had been on double sessions most of the time I went through. They had to build a new school, the town did. So they cut out any kind of physical education, basically, except for baseball and softball and foot. No, we didn't even have football. It was very, very limited. So I get to the university and I'm with people that have done a lot of swimming, a lot of gymnastics, a lot of, yeah, sports, but things that I had not had any kind of introduction to. Well, needless to say, I was pretty awful. So I wasn't doing well in that discipline. And I go to the first classes. They give us a list of books we have to buy. I go the way, the path to the bookstore to buy them. And there was this path that split, and one way went to the bookstore, and one way went to the history department. Now, we had a certain amount of courses you had to take in the discipline you were studying, and then you had these things that you sort of had to take or recommended, but normally it was like you could take art or music, things like that, to try to give you a rounded education. And then they'd have, like, you could take anything you wanted. And every time it was take anything you wanted, I took a history course. So what stopped me at that intersection was, do I pursue physical education, go get the books, do not what I probably won't do very well? Or do I go to the history department and change my major? I couldn't make a decision. All I remember is standing there. And I don't remember what I was thinking about. It was just like I went into this non-think. Oh my God, I got to make this huge decision. What do I do? And the next thing I know, and I figured it out, I stood there for over an hour. Because when I got to the history department, I looked at the clock and I said, oh my God. My class stopped, and I've been out there an hour thinking about this, and I don't even know. I don't remember making the decision. I just knew all of a sudden I was walking into the Department of History. So I changed my major. Now, it was late in the game already, and a lot of the more popular history courses were already filled. So I kind of had to fill in where there was room. And one of those was the history of Russia. And another one was Russian society. So I've got these two courses. And one of the things that I think caused me to make that big break in my major was because the relationship I had broken up, and emotionally I was pretty distraught, and I did not do good in college. I was a C student at best. So, except in history, and I had A's. So, and this wasn't, I'd been in the history department for a while. This went on. I mean, it was during my junior year that all this real garbage stuff happened. And so I don't know how to explain it, because I don't think it's that unusual to people that suddenly, and I mean, there's people that tell you that demonic evil entities can force you into suicidal thoughts or some kind of drug. I wasn't taking drugs. So I can't tell you why, except that I was a very unhappy person. But I'm walking over to the bookstore thing again, and it was in the student union. Well, they were going to build a new student union, and they had dug this huge hole. I mean, I think it might have gone down. I don't know. It was deep, and there was a bridge that they had built, kind of over the edge of it. And I'm on this bridge, and all of a sudden I stopped, and I honestly was suicidal and thought, I'm just going to jump over the railing here. Now, I don't even know if I would have killed myself, to be honest. But I know what my mindset was at the time. And this, I was going to do this. And all of a sudden, to my left, I hear this very melodious, friendly, loving male voice that said to me, "You have many decisions in your life, but this is not one of them." I turned around and it was so spooky. I had heard it. There wasn't anybody there. I had heard this voice as clear as I have ever heard anything in my life. And I go back to the dorm. No, I wasn't in the dorm. I was in a private house at that time. And I go in there and I go up to my room and I'm kind of in a daze. And I sit down in front of the desk, and on the desk is the Russian history book. And I sort of started to look through it. We had something we had to, and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to do my homework type of thing. And all of a sudden, I had this massive change. And I focused so intently on the Russian history book that I became obsessed with it. For the last year of my college time I was in there, I was continually studying, and I mean studying, not just Russian history, but Russian society. So when I graduated, I had a major in history, but I had a minor in Russian studies. Well, this becomes very critical because, again, another weird kind of story. One of my friends from college was going to be in the area, and the only place that we both knew was the government center there in the big city, Worcester. So we agreed we'd meet there. And I got there an hour before we were supposed to meet. And I'm walking around this building, and they've got recruitment offices for the Army, Navy, Air Force. And I go into the Navy, and I again, not thinking about what I'm doing, I'm just doing it. And I said to them, "Do you have any kind of a recruitment program for women?" They looked at each other and they all, "No." "Oh, okay." So I go down, there's another door, Air Force. "Do you have?" And I asked the same question, and they were like, "Yes, we do, but it's very difficult to get in here." And they were kind of like stern and weird. Well, what I discovered later, because a few years after that, the Air Force was actually sued by women who were very qualified to join their ranks, but they weren't knockout beauties. And that's the only thing they were hiring. The Air Force women had to be like, beauty stars. And they won the case. So I think I was getting that kind of a reaction from the Air Force. So the third door is the Army. And I go in there and I ask the same question, and they went, "Oh yes, we have a very good program. If you did you go to college?" "Yes, I did." "Well, with your college degree, you can have a direct commission as an officer in the United States Army." "Oh, okay. All you have to do is we'll get in contact with you and we'll set up a testing that tests your eyes, your ears, the physical. You get, that you pass the physical requirements. And also you'll get a test on, I think they called it a psychological test." And so, oh, well, okay. I mean, I didn't have a job at the time. So it was like, whatever, And so this lieutenant, female, contacts me and arranges to pick me up and take me to the testing facilities. And I had perfect eyesight, perfect hearing. And the psychological test was very, very interesting because one of the things that I would take when I could take a free course was psychology. I just found it kind of fascinating. And I knew enough about psychology to know that this test was trying to determine if you were a little crazy. And by then, I'm considering what I'm doing. What am I doing? I don't want to be in the army. I mean, I had, supported the fight against the being in Vietnam. This wasn't something I said, "Whoa, yeah, let's do that." Never occurred to me, except that I had to go to that building. So I look at the test and I start to answer the questions the way I thought a crazy person would answer them, not somebody that was totally sane. And it wasn't as stark as that, but the tendencies, the attitudes, your preconceived way of looking at things. I was like, I'm going to make them think I'm a little crazy, and maybe they'll say, "No, we don't want you." Well, I guess that's the kind of person they wanted, because boy, did they want me. But they had a 2-year waiting list to get a direct commission into the army. So that's again how that's how I got into the army. It was like just being guided there. And 2 years later, I mean, I spent the next 2 years having an oh, wow. I mean, I had a lot of really crazy things. Like I left I left Massachusetts and I went down to Florida. Now, I went to Miami because a friend of mine was down there and she said, "Why don't you come down and you're out of between jobs." I was between jobs. "Why don't you come down and spend a couple weeks?" "Oh, all right." But I didn't have any transportation. So I have to stop at the, it was like a sandwich shop, hamburgers, that type of thing. And I have to stop there. I think it was to pick up milk or something, because it also was the milk where we buy milk. But I stopped there and I see a high school friend of mine. And so I go over and I say, "Hey, how are you?" And she said, "Well, we're just having lunch. Why don't you sit down and have lunch with us?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." Well, it turned out that she had two kids, which were with her there. And was on her way back to Florida. And she was looking for somebody to drive down with her. So I thought about it. I said, "I'm between jobs. Gail has invited me down there, and now I got a ride." So I said, "Yeah, I'll drive down with you," which I did. But she got off in Jacksonville, which is the northern part of the state. And Florida's the longest state in the union. Maybe California's more, but it's a long state. So I had to take a bus to get to Miami. I was on the bus, I think, longer than it took us to drive to Massachusetts to Jacksonville. It was the worst trip I ever took was on that bus. It stopped at every single stop. But I get here in Coral Gables, I mean, Coconut Grove. And I stayed for until the Army called me up. I had a lot of very, very strange experiences, and so many of them that, yeah, maybe I'll by the end of this book, I'll tell some of them. But one of them was I worked in a restaurant, and I had the day shift, the breakfast type of thing, and lunch. And while I was there, we were getting ready to have a shift change. And this young man comes in and he walked over to me and he said, "Ooh, I like you." And I thought, well, that's a kind of a brash way of somebody introducing themselves. He said, "I'm the night shift chef." And I said, "Oh, okay, nice to meet you." And he said, I get off at, I think it was 10 o'clock or something. He said, why don't you stop by and we'll hang out a bit? Because at night they had a bar in the, outside bar, and it was one of the places that people wanted to be. And he was cute and he was personable. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll try to make it. And I did. And that started a relationship with this guy that was one of the, well, I mean, boy, again, he opened me up to a whole bunch of woo. It turned out that he was incredibly psychic. Incredibly psychic. When I went shopping for his birthday, it was his birthday, I wanted to give him something. I go shopping. I come day of his birthday and I give him the present. And he looked at it and he said, yeah, I like this one best. And I said, what do you mean? And he proceeded to tell me about every single thing that I had looked at shopping for his birthday present. It's like he could remote view me. And I didn't understand remote view at all at that time. But, it was like, oh my God. I mean, it was like really, really, really strange. And he told me a story. Well, he had scars all over his body. I mean, he must have had four of them. Maybe, I think there was four of them. And they were bullet holes. I'm going like, well, you look like you got bullet holes in you. And he said, yeah, they are bullet holes. And I said, what's that about? And he said, I was in Vietnam and I had no idea of that. And I said, oh. He said, yeah, I was a gunner on a helicopter ship and got shot out of the helicopter four times and survived. I mean, twice he fell out of the helicopter. So, I mean, he had defied death four times in Vietnam of bullet wounds that, I mean, they were in the middle of his body. It wasn't like his arm or, it was like in his chest. Okay. Well, again, it was another meeting of a p person who taught me something more about woo-woo reality. And there's another event that was associated with a university. When Vietnam was happening, people realized that this is a bogus war. What are we doing there? And probably anybody that's, a little bit older, you know why. Because it was in reality, it was the rubber plantation money people that caused all that 50,000 dying. So, Vietnam. Kent State happened, where National Guardsmen actually killed a number of students at Kent State University and wounded some others. That sent the universities and colleges into a complete state of insurrection. I don't use that word lightly. At the University of Massachusetts, they had students that got together in rooms in the student union. Those rooms were hooked up telephonically with Berkeley in California, Berkeley University. I've done a lot of army stuff and war games and played games with, command centers and this sort of thing. I have never seen a command center as well run as that or as efficient. And what actually happened in the days after, well, actually weeks after Kent State, was that there were rallies on every university and college. And one by one, every university and college virtually in the United States shut down. You're not going to find this information. I was there. was very well hidden. And we knew this because everybody's talking to everybody, and there'd be another pin in the map saying that this college is shut down. The University of Massachusetts itself was shut down. They were not holding their normal schedule. What they were doing was that they would have different classes, but they were more like places that people could talk about what was really happening. It was phenomenal. Now, when this happened, it was my senior year. When this happened, I was another long story, but I was a voting member of the Faculty of History as a student because the history department realized that the unrest that was showing itself on the colleges and universities and had been for years was dangerous. And so they were trying to be able to tell the students, well, we've got a student representative here, I was voted in, and we work with the students and blah, 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 to try to keep themselves safe. So, I was that student, so I didn't participate directly in any of the things that happened, but I did watch them, observe, see what was happening. And one of the things they did at the University of Massachusetts that was innovative is that they got at least 1,000 people to march down to the Bank of Amherst. Now the college sits the it's with I think it's right to the side of the city limits. I mean, it's Amherst is right there with the university. And to go from the rally point, they had all these people in this rally point, and then to march down the main street to the bank, it probably was a mile, or maybe a little less, but I'm off on my distances. But and this happened. Now again, I didn't have any money in the Amherst Bank, but the point was, all these people were going to go to the Amherst Bank and make a run on the bank in protest of Vietnam and the Kent State shootings and, basically the way the country was going, insurrection. So they went to take out $1. And they said, if this doesn't get on the air, because that we couldn't get the publicity. So if this doesn't get on the airways, we're going to come back tomorrow and we're going to take out all of our money, which would have bankrupted the Amherst Bank very quickly. So that's what happened. But they never had a second day. And yet I know for a fact that they never got covered in the CBS, NBC, ABC stations, and they were all it was. And I know that not because of what I saw at the university, because they did it and then it was over with and they never did any more with it. And so I never really thought about it again until I was in the Army and I was with a unit that was having a bit of a unit barbecue. And the master sergeant of the unit came up and he sat down beside me and he says to me, "You went to the University of Massachusetts." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Did you happen to be involved in the run on the Bank of Amherst?" And I was like stunned. I went, "Well, I wasn't involved, but I was there." And he said, "Did you see the TV cameras?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I saw them." He said, "I just want you to know this." And again, why is he telling me this? He said, "I want you to know this, that we got there, we were monitoring everything from almost the time it started." So the conversations going from the University of Massachusetts in Berkeley were being monitored by the unit that I eventually became part of, which was called SIGSEC, Signal Security. And they could monitor telephones. They do it all the time. And this is what his job was. They were monitoring. And they found out about this run on the banks, on the bank. And so what they did was they got down there, and the cameras from ABC, NBC, CBS, the Army, the United States military, forced the media to give them the film that was in the cameras. They never even filmed it before it ever happened. They took the film. And they said to him, "Now you pretend you're filming." Okay. Now, this is woo-woo in that it's that really strange way that information would come to me. But there's the other side of what I was learning, and that was, let's say, the profile of the deep state. And I'm, you know, when you've heard other Say What shows and other shows I do, I'm a fanatic about news and current events, geopolitical situations. I'm a junkie. But I know it because I was led to try to understand the size and power of people who were behind the government. So that's part of my mission. If they go out of their mind, out of their way to make sure that I know certain facts that I wouldn't get any other way, they want me to understand the full complexity of this deep state. Well, recently, and by recently, I mean in the last few years, I've understood a few things. And one of them is the reason that people don't really talk about and embrace the things that are what I'm calling woo-woo. The things that are weird, the people that seem to be able to see the future or read your aura or tarot cards out of all this stuff and reincarnation. How come people fight against this? Well, there's a lot of data. There's a huge amount of data. Why are people still fighting it? And I told you in the beginning of the book that the Inquisition came in and said anybody that believes in this is a witch. And so we should kill them because they're working with evil powers. Well, the other side of it is the deep dark state. They don't want you to know this information because they need to control you. And if you realize that you are incredibly important, incredibly powerful, that your mind can dictate reality, it goes back to those. In cosmic reality, I was guided to write the book around the rules of cosmic reality. And the first rule is reality is what you think it is. So when I was telling you about the timelines and how it's a consensus of people who think of as things are real in certain ways that comes together that creates a timeline. Because they're believing in that timeline, you have the energy generated to, let's say, propel the timeline to make it real. Well, this same concept of how many people are believing in something, okay, that creates the timeline. But the people that are creating the imaging that create the timeline, you, me, reality is what we think it is. So if you knew that you had powers beyond the, people so many times say, "Oh, there's nothing I can do about it." Sure, there is. But they're not going to tell you that. So the first rule is reality is what you think it is. The second rule is majority wins. Like I told you, that's why you get the timelines. A majority of people begin to perceive the same reality, and that reality they're focused on, they're creating, they're manifesting by engaging their energy in it. Well, the third rule is anybody in power will keep you from knowing rule one and two. And that was the big thing that I had to learn and that we all have to learn. The reason that people don't want to, think in terms of woo-woo reality, of metaphysics, of paranormal events, is because it's a danger to the dark side. The dark side is promoting a visual presentation of a reality that's fake. They're keeping everybody from knowing the true implications of what we can do, what reality really is, what it can become. And as long as they don't let us see this alternative reality where there are angels and spirits and gnomes and the dragons do live still around us, it's in an energy form of all sorts of unbelievable mind expanding, wow. If everybody believed that, they wouldn't put up with the BS that the dark side's telling us. So this is the other aspect of why did the sergeant tell me that? Because I needed to know the full depth of their evil. Why did they send that messenger bringing me wood and a message about this guy that I told a secret to, not thinking of it as a secret, that resulted in the people who were watching him stealing my notes, figuring a college student, once we've got the notes, they're probably going to just kind of forget it, which was true. But the guy that had listened to me was out there trying to fight the summation of the Warren Commission. They had to get him out of the way. So they killed him. And what she was giving me in the message is be careful. They're out there. If you go too far, too fast, they'll come after you. Why was the Sigset message delivered? They're everywhere. Be careful. Just know they're there. They're enemies. They want to keep you in the dark. They want to take the film out of the cameras. So I'm going to end the show right now. And when I'm editing it and things, I'll probably think of other things that I should have said. But remember, we're doing something different. I'm telling you stories, giving you my input on the reality behind those stories. And then we'll bring it together and we'll make us a book. I'm having fun. And thank you for participating. Now, on the 20th December, Jan and Ani are planning to be on the Say What show. So just be aware that we'll get the girls back for at least one more show before the year is up. Be safe, everybody. Appreciate you.
Say what? Say what radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.